So welcome to Agribusiness Matters. My name is Venki Ramachandran, and Agribusiness Matters is an endeavor to discover systems thinking in agriculture in an age of runaway climate change. Today, I'm really excited to talk to Ajay Veer Jakhar. I've been following Ajay Veer Jakhar's works for quite some time now, and I'm really, really excited. I think, you know, it's very difficult for me to pin a particular sort of definition of what the work Ajay does, but we will get into it. But really, thank you very, very much, Ajay, for joining us in this podcast.
Thank you for having me here.
Great. You know, one of the things that I really find fascinating in the work you do is your voice and your perspectives that you bring are fairly at a very middle path. You know, in terms of at one level, you know, balancing what, you know, in terms of the kind of support agriculture needs, and at the same time also helping farmers ask very deeper questions. So maybe I want to start off with the simple question of what is the idea behind Bharat Krishak Samaj, right? Today, there are so many organizations that are that purportedly work for the benefit of farmers, right? There are farmer right activist organizations, there are farmer unions, and there are so many organizations at this point. You know, India is such a vast, complex ecosystem where we see various kinds of organizations. So I'm curious to understand, what is the central idea behind Bharat Krishak Samaj?
Bharat Krishak Samaj was formed in 1955 by Punjab Rao Deshmukh ji. He was from Maharashtra. He was an institution builder.
Achha.
So Bharat Krishak Samaj tries to create a common meeting ground where everyone interested in strengthening the food systems can meet, put the intelligence, resources, energy to good use to help those engaged in producing more from their land. Now this is what Bharat Krishak Samaj was formed for in 1955. And this is what we've been trying to do in the last so many years. And I'm happy to say that we've managed to create a space where we managed to convene different voices to come together on the same platform to discuss issues which seem very contentious. When you look at it, we get to see that people think they have great differences, but when people sit together in a room, in a very good atmosphere, they when they get up, they realize that the differences are not too many and they can be resolved. So this is what Bharat Krishak Samaj is trying to do, is trying to get different voices and trying to build a consensus on policy that will improve farmer livelihoods.
Great. And, you know, it's very interesting, you know, when you're talking about the forum, right? I think given the multifaceted nature of this entire elephant called Indian agriculture, and I think bringing a forum is really endearing to me, because I think there is one of the major problems is most of the stakeholders don't really talk to each other and are often tend to get locked in their silos. In your description of Bharat Krishak Samaj in the website, I saw that it's a non-political and non-sectarian organization, right? And I want to maybe start off with that and also look at the question of how do you see the role of politics here, right? For people like us, you know, people like me who works in the agri-tech domain, you know, we often see it's very frustrating many times to see that, it almost seems like it's like an albatross around the neck and you can't really separate the two, right? You see the buyers coming in with a lot of political agenda there. And there is always this question of, how do you, you know, it is like I can neither, you know, make the politics go away, and at the same time, it's such a difficulty to deal with. So in your, given the work that you do, how do you see politics as such, approach politics here?
So when you look at farmer organizations, different farmer organizations, which have a large support base, they are normally aligned with a political party and aligned with a political thought. They're aligned with an ideology. And I think that's counterproductive to the farmer movement, in the sense that if you look at the farmer organizations associated with BJP, they would be less active when the BJP is now in power. And the same goes with the Congress party or with other regional parties. When their particular mentors or parties they associated with are in power, they will not agitate too much. They will not give demands which aren't practical. They will keep quiet when issues become emotional and flare up. So generally, they go with the flow of politics, and they do not land up changing policy too much. If you even look at agitations that take place, what agitations manage to achieve normally is a status quo of what exists. Mm. Rather than come up with positive policy changes and reforms that will actually change the situation for the better. And it's unfortunate, but this is how democracy works, and this is how farmer organizations are structured.
Interesting. So, I mean, I want to maybe take it as a follow-up, right, in terms of, you know, you talked about agitations are largely, you know, bring back the status quo, right? And that's where I think of, I mean, when I look at a farmer organization vis-a-vis a farmer's union, I'm curious to understand, how do you see the difference? Because I see, you know, there's a lot of farmer unions that, you know, that are championing, and you know, and across the states, I've seen different cultures, right? You come to Tamil Nadu, you'll see the green sort of, you know, towel that's worn. That's often the symbols of the farmer unions that I've seen. So how do you see this role of a farmer organization vis-a-vis a farmer union?
No, I think all organizations have a role to play. And I think all organizations try to do it within the circumstances they live in. And all organizations have their compulsions. And we must understand it from that lens, that no farmer organization is free to do what they want. They have to meet the aspirations of their members. They have to make a compromise on what they're seeking on their behalf. And they also are constrained by their own members' understanding of issues, which may be much different than what the leaders understand issues as. Where I feel disillusioned with some of the many farmer unions is that they do not spend time and effort educating their farmers on implications of policies that will take them out of the status quo we live in. So till the moment you do not talk to farmer members or to the general farmer public, farmers on the ground, about the implications of reforms, you know, how things could improve and how things could improve, how could those improvements be scaled up, they are not going to get support from their own members to look at reforms. So they are constrained by the understanding of their own members also, of understanding of issues or understanding of implications of reforms. And that's why we will find that farmer unions do not talk about contentious issues like free electricity, draining aquifers. They will not talk about monoculture of paddy and wheat. They will seek, at one stage, they will seek agroecology, they will seek organic produce, but at the same time, they will seek cheaper fertilizers. They will want GST removed on pesticides. They will not talk about elections to marketing boards. They will not talk about improving governance in mandis so that farmers can get better prices. They will not talk about scientist recruitments in universities and colleges. So these, you know, they are issues which do not resonate necessarily with farmers, and farmer union leaders do tend to avoid such issues where they think that their leadership may suffer as a consequence. And these are circumstances we live in.
Why do farmers not have much say on the policies, right? Because at one level, theoretically, it feels like they are a majority vote bank. And they definitely had to have more say on the policies. And especially when you look at a global context, right? Where in, let's say, in countries like US, where the farmer population is much smaller, it seems like they have a much better say on the policies than in an Indian context where, you know, where you see that they're a big vote bank that every party wants to sort of appeal to, but at the same time, the policies have no bearing with them. How do you explain this contradiction for yourself?
I think so. We should not be comparing Indian farmers with farmers in the USA. Many social media influencers, many economists, many columnists tend to do that because it sounds exciting. It sounds it's eye-popping. You know, like in the US, only 2% of the population is involved directly with agriculture, compared to 40% in India. Mm. And United States of America is hundreds of times better in the sense with availability of resources that they can deploy for public good. And we are not in that kind of a financial position to do so. So while the US economy needs to support only 2% of its population, we need, with its strong economy, we need to support 40% of the population with a weak economy. So I think so. It's not a good comparison.
That's
a basic difference. The other thing is that the farmers in the US are more educated. You will find that the US normally every 5 years or 6 years gets a new farm law, a new farm bill, which turns around how support is being given to farmers. Now, and this happens on a regular basis. If you ask me about an agriculture policy that the Indian government has, I don't remember in the recent past of anyone coming out with an agriculture policy. So, and here is United States, which churns its policy every few years. You look at China, we tend to compare ourselves with China. Even China compares how it gives subsidies. It was very focused on a minimum support price earlier. Now it's giving some other kind of support. So they keep churning policies. They keep trying new methods. There's no guaranteed success of what we do, but they learn from their mistakes and they keep changing. So for example, now in the US, the government is changing support to risk insurance from price and from production. So policies must evolve, and that is not happening in India. The other difference also is that farmer unions in the US are more commodity based. So you could have a grain council, you could have a union which talks for only for maize farmers or for only apple growers.
Yeah, bargaining councils also there. Yeah.
Yes, unlike India, where we only where you have unions which speak for all farmers, and farmers are different kinds. So they could be farmers which are rain-fed farmers, they could be irrigated farmers. They have completely different issues. You could have farmers which receive MSP, farmers which do not receive MSP. They are completely different. They have completely different issues. We generally tend to generalize all farmers in the same bracket, and that's why success is elusive for getting out of that status quo.
Yeah, no, there are various points that you're mentioning that are very interesting, right? One of the reasons where probably, you know, there is a oftentimes a comparison that we end up doing despite the difference of context is that we often have these fancy ideas of Arthur Lewis old models where we think that at some stage, you know, we will have a similar model which what we see right now in OECD countries, right? And so probably that is also one of the reasons, you know, where we almost, I mean, every other economist has an idea that at some stage we have to, I mean, you talk to them, they say at some stage they'll bring the structural transformation and then they say that no, we have to do. But at least I'm glad now, at least now, like when I hear Ramesh Chand ji in the recent some of the conversations, I hear him talk about challenging some of these things. But I think that's also one of the reasons where we typically tend to compare, you know, with other countries' context there.
We tend to pick and choose, you know, we tend to pick and choose what we want to compare. So if you want to show that Indian farmers are getting less support, you will talk about support versus the US. If you want to talk about ecosystem services or cash transfers, maybe you would talk about EU or something. So people tend to pick and choose the comparisons they want. They form narratives based on the articulation, and they confuse farmers even more, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's a great point to bring this aspect into the whole question of supporting farmers, right? One of the reasons why I really love your perspectives and I follow what you write and what you post in your social media feeds very eagerly is I see a sort of a middle path in how you look at support, right? Because at one end today, you know, when I sort of frame the entire spectrum of support here, right? We have you know, the legacy of Sharad Joshi, right, who talks about negative subsidy and who talks about, I mean, today the Shetkari Krishi Sangathan and the work they're doing in terms of, and the kind of work they talk about in terms of wanting to remove farmers from the clutches of the constitution, from the you know, to sort of liberate farmers, I mean, to liberate farmers from the clutches of the constitution and help them get access to unfettered markets at one end. And then the other end, we have, you know, pure sort of a, you know, full-fledged support in terms of, you know, making sure that the notion MSP is also politically tied, legal, and so many other aspects, right? So this, in this kind of a broad spectrum, I really find your voice in a slightly in a middle path there. So I'm curious, how do you look at the idea of support here, right? Are you, I mean, or the other way to ask this question is, at what stage support tends to hobble farmers, and at what stage support tends to help farmers?
You know, when you go, when I go, you would go and talk to farmers and landless labor, small and marginal farmers, and you say 75 years of budget, agriculture policy support, subsidies, have you been empowered to lead a life of dignity? And answer most of the times is no. Now, that could be because of aspirations or other things, but there is a general sense of disappointment of their lives when they compare themselves with other sections of society. And this is notwithstanding government's humongous sums that they have put under PM Kisan, free electricity, subsidized fertilizer, minimum support price procurements. You know, all sorts of subsidies and support prices are being given to farmers. But something is amiss, something is missing. And that's why we need to relook at this whole scenario, that are we looking at how do you support farmers that their life will be more dignified? And I'm increasingly veering around to believing that universal basic services is the answer. But also, if you look at, you know, what is quality of life, when you look at the economists, you look at the Ministry of Finance, or you look at other senior people everywhere, they equate it with consumption. And I think that's wrong. Like, they compare it with GDP. And long ago, this idea of comparing quality of life with GDP became conventional wisdom and is seldom questioned, you know, in policy making. The paradox today is that farmers are also consumers. If you look at farmers, I think so, the very few farmers who grow everything that they need, farmers also need to go to the market to buy what they eat. So it's not that farmers are growing everything within their own farm. Most farmers are not doing that. I mean, I think maybe even 90% of farmers are not doing that today. And if you say a century ago, what happened? You would not have vegetable shops. You would not have shops selling vegetables and food in the villages, because they were more self-contained communities which were not improving human capacity. So today you have these shops selling vegetables, which is proof that farmers are not growing everything that they require, and maybe they should not also do that. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Now, when everyone is a consumer, the priority of this government, of India, Indian government, irrespective of which political party is in power or which will be in power in future, or if you look at countries anywhere in the world, nobody is going to allow food inflation to rise beyond a point. The priority of every government in the world today is to make sure that food inflation does not go up. Food inflation leads to crisis. You look at the Arab Spring that happened in Egypt. You look at what happened in Tunisia. There was a revolution in 2008 when prices went up. You look at Yemen. You look at other countries. Everywhere, every time food prices go up, there will be unrest, there will be civil war, and there will be other consequences of power being changed. So when the governments are not going to allow farm gate prices to rise, there's no way that farmers can live a life of dignity based on demands of increasing food prices. I'm not saying we should not increase demand, but we must realize the fact that these are circumstances and this is the context that we are discussing in. There are very few farmers who get MSP. There are even fewer farmers who get MSP for both the crops they grow in a year. And can this be scaled up? Every political party will promise before the elections, like it is happening now, that they will give MSP for all the crops. But let me tell you that it's not going to happen. It cannot happen. These are demands which cannot be met. People who are asking for them also realize that they can't be met. But this is how you gain support of the people, by giving them stories. If you look at cash transfers, I think the simplistic reactions to inherently complex problems. You may give 500 rupees a month to SPM Kisan, or you could even give 2000 rupees, you know. But will it be sufficient to cover the cost of that family's cost of education, healthcare, medication, food, transportation, his internet connection, or his household expenses? No, because inflation will destroy any gains that you get by rising cash transfers. And that's why I'm trying to articulate this point of view, and there are not many people who agree to it, is that we are also because we are not in a situation to distribute large sums of money economically as a nation. So what do we do in such a situation when the government is unable to create employment in large numbers that farmers' children can be, you know, productively employed in other professions? When you look at new technologies which are coming in, they will improve efficiencies, which will further hinder employment generation. Private investment is not keeping pace. So the whole idea is that how do you make people's life more fulfilling? How do you improve their livelihoods? Then the question is, I mean, the answer to this whole thing I find is that we should be focusing on universal basic services rather than cash transfers and general subsidies which go out to the whole community. And basic services could mean world-class education, healthcare, public toilets, sanitation, drinking water, a roof over every head. I think we should be focusing on the public good. And what you focus on depends on how much money you have. And that's the key point, is where are India's finances? What is our physical position? And where, how much money can be deployed? But what should we deploy it for is what we are discussing now. And I think universal basic services is the answer to improving livelihoods of those at the bottom of the pyramid. And that bottom of the pyramid is something like 25-30% of India's population. That's what I think it is. And this is not to say that we stop giving minimum support price, but we need to focus our priorities better. That's what I'm trying to articulate. And it's difficult for people to understand because they are so stuck up in their own thoughts that they've had for so many years. And accepting a new thought, in a way, to them feels that they've been wrong with what they've been advocating for the last 20-30 years, and they don't want to get that idea into the head. But I think so, it's an idea whose time has come, and ideas have their own way. And this is how I think so thinking is going to change and evolve as we go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is what I want to maybe, before we get into other topics, I just want to maybe delve a little bit deeper in this aspect, right? Because at one level, what you're saying is extremely commonsensical. And at another level, I can totally understand when, you know, when you're probably proposing this in policy forums or farmer forums, this might sound, this might sound really upsetting. So, you know, I really liked in one of your conversations, I think you spoke about how you look at your work as like almost like a, you know, an Inception kind of a movie, right, where you plant an idea. So can you maybe show us, give us a bit of a glimpse of for planting an idea of universal basic services in, let's say, government officials or the ministry or there, how that would really look like? Maybe some glimpse, if it's possible.
So you know, when somebody asked me what do you do as a farmers organization, so I said we try and incept ideas, and so that people can take those ideas as their own ideas.
Yeah.
You know, it's very easy for people to fully back an idea when they think they own the idea. And so that's what I think so is policy is about. We should not claim an idea to be our own, because the moment you claim an idea to be your own, then people don't want to support you as much. So you got to allow people to be a part of formation of that idea. We take ideas to different officials. That could be at Niti Aayog, that could be in the Prime Minister's office, it could be in the various ministries with various farmer organizations, or even talking on a podcast, Venki, with you, which is so good, or talking to other columnists, those TV personalities, you know, taking these conversations on a one-to-one basis, I think so, is very important. And that's what we try and do. We incept ideas, we try and get them to think on these ideas. It's not an easy, fast process. It takes time for such ideas to form. But this is what we try and do.
Yeah,
sometimes it seems like it's a losing game, but you know, when you're focused on an idea, like I said, these ideas will grow on people and they will talk about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I was reading up your, how in 2018, when for the Punjab State Farmers Commission you had given and the government was sitting on it and kind of had to almost drop that. So I can see how much of that journey must have been in terms of to take these policies and bring the change at the ground. One question I want to also delve a little bit deeper in what you briefly touched about is in your conversations in previous places, you also talked about supporting Narega vis-a-vis PM Kisan, and you also briefly touched upon it in this conversation we are having right now, right? At one level, the common argument is like, I talked to some of the folks in Karnataka, right? Everybody is like, the labor is shortage because Narega has spoiled them. Right? That's a common argument that keeps coming up oftentimes, that Narega has sort of inhibited in a certain sense labor. And of course there are multi-dimensional aspects there, but I'm curious, what is the argument for you to sort of place Narega as propose that over PM Kisan here?
No, I'm not proposing one or the other. That's what I'm trying to say. There's a whole package of practices and policies that will need to come up, and different areas will require different solutions. Where I live in, where my village is, where my son is farming, it's a place called Abohar. It is it's on the border with Punjab, Haryana, Rajasthan, and Pakistan. So it's an area which has a very diversified agriculture in Punjab, possibly very high diversification compared to the rest of the country. Now, we have a huge labor shortage there. We do not have labor most of the year because we have a diversified economy. So we need a different kind of support system there. If you go to, let's say, Sangrur, which is the constituency of the Chief Minister of Punjab, there you have a monoculture of paddy and wheat. Now, while in our area, we have employment for labor on a very easy basis for 300 days in a year at least. In Sangrur, I think agriculture labor does not have employment for even 100 days a year because of a monoculture is mechanized and there is not much labor requirement. And that's why you will find one of the maximum number of suicides happening in his constituency. You will find a maximum number of farmer agitations in that area. You will find the water depth, aquifers are deepest in that area. So I think everything is correlated and different areas will require different solutions. And that's the complexity of improving farmer livelihoods. It's different. There's not going to be a final solution. You will have to keep tweaking it and allowing for this change to come in. Now, when you come to Narega particularly, where I am, as a farmer who owns land, and I, with all the farmers who own land, I think I would have preferred if because who decides when Narega work is going to be given? It's demand based, so there are 50, 60 days or 100 days of a year when there is more demand, if let's say cotton picking season is there. Let me give you a very specific example.
Sure.
2 months ago, there was a cotton picking season. There is a huge shortage of labor in the cotton picking season. So I would say in that 30 days not to give Narega work, because then that labor would be available for cotton picking, because the labor would get work on the farm while the labor would get work through Narega on off when work was not available on the farm. So I think this tweaking can be done. We should not be stuck on ideologies. People make policies sitting in Jharkhand and other places for the whole country. And I think that's the problem with policy. Everybody comes with a context of where the experiences are. And based on that experiences of a few districts or a state or two states, then policies are made because they're able to influence it for the whole country. And I think that is where the problem is. We need more differentiated, there needs to be more complexity in policies. So that's the problem.
Yeah, and I think it's a good segue to look at when you're saying complexity in the policy, right? I think you and I had, when we met in Delhi, we had almost an argument about the taxing agricultural income, right? Today, Bibek Debroy has been talking about it in Indian Express and other forums. In fact, I have, based on some of the conversations I've been having with some of the people, I've almost written in my newsletter that when BJP comes to power in 2024, sure we can expect taxing of agricultural income. I had almost written that, but you know, when I was very fascinated by your perspective when we talked about the difficulty of taxing agricultural income, right? Of course, it's a state subject, and which means that, you know, we are talking about a huge you know, complex beast here, right? And I'm curious, right? Because even many of the conversations we typically tend to have about farmer reforms, there is always this question of you know, like some of the basic aspects, right? Like even making sure that the pan is there, or making sure that certain, at least there's a sales recipe, right? Then that those of the conditions tend to get so basic at some level that one almost wishes that if there were at least some kind of a taxation, maybe there could be some equity that could flow back into the system. So I'm curious, you know, to sort of hear your thoughts and perspectives on what do you think is the difficulty of taxing agricultural income per se?
Well, first of all, agriculture is a state subject, and to my understanding, personally, and as a farmers organization, the union government cannot tax it because it's not in their purview as per the Constitution of India.
Yeah.
Let's be very clear on that. Second point is that farmers are being taxed. Let's not say farmers are not being taxed. Farmers are being taxed indirectly. When the government does not allow us to export or produce, it subdues prices. So, for example, today there is...
Gulati has been talking about it for a while, yeah.
Who has been talking about it?
Mr. Ashok Gulati?
Oh, no. Just leave economists out of it.
okay, all right.
One of the problems I face is because economists are not on the ground. But if you look at sugar, you look at wheat, you look at rice, they're not being allowed for export. So, if you don't allow produce to be exported, then the farm gate prices get subdued. So I would say that is also a form of a tax, right? So farmers are being taxed. When we procure goods on GST, we do not get input for it, right? Because it's designed in a way. I'm not saying we should get input, but I'm saying you get benefit of the GST that you're putting on, giving on things that you're buying from the market. Other than that, I would also say that the cost of collecting tax will be higher than the actual collections. See, when you collect a tax, there's a cost of collecting that tax. And I think cost of collecting the tax will be far higher than what the government will actually collect. And I will explain that, you know. So a lot of the problems come in is because newspapers report that people are reporting very high agriculture incomes. And then people, Venki, like you, and people who do not know how a farmer keeps his accounts actually, will then seek taxation on agriculture. For example, if there's a businessman who's running an enterprise or a shop or a thing, they will factor in expenses as expenses for income tax. So the labor that they use, or depreciation for the machinery they buy, or equipment they buy, even a refrigerator or an air conditioner they buy, or cars they buy, they will get depreciation for all those things. If they travel for work, they will add it as expenses, and they will subtract those expenses from their gross income, and then come up with a figure that they will show for taxation. Unlike farmers, what they do, farmers, when you say what is agriculture income, it's basically their sale proceeds minus their labor, and labor that they pay for, not their own salaries and stuff like that, which businesses do, and they will pay for fertilizers and things like that. They will not talk about depreciation. They will not talk about other expenses, which if taxed, they will start, you know, making their returns based on how businesses make. And I think the cost of collection will be far higher than the actual collections. And also it will bring a lot of problems for lots of people from the income tax department, because who they will go after, not go after, it's going to be a problem. And I'll give you an indication. I mean, I'll just give you an anecdote of what happened. So we've been invited for these pre-budget discussions with the Ministry of Finance. So in one of the discussions, when late Arun Jaitley ji was heading the discussion personally, it had come in the newspaper a day before that, that, you know, farmers were showing lakhs and crores of incomes and stuff like that. So on that day, we proposed to the minister himself, where the whole team of his IS officers and other farmer organizations were also there, were sitting, is I said the best way to do it is ask a farmers organization to do a forensic audit of those which are showing excess incomes, farmer incomes, where you think that farmers are showing a lot of income. Let's say you draw a ballpark figure of whatever, 10 lakhs, 20 lakhs or something, and you say farmers are showing higher income, or their companies which are showing hundreds of crores of incomes. Do a forensic audit. And as a farmers organization, Bharat Krishik Samaj actually offered to them in the meeting that give us 100 returns and we'll do a forensic audit, and we will tell you how is he fudging figures. But obviously nothing came out of it. So I think the income tax department would not even have the wherewithal to check how farmers are showing income or not showing income. I think that there's a huge gap in it, and I'm not in favor of farmers being taxed the way things stand today.
Yeah, maybe, you know, I think there's a lot of areas of nuance in this aspect, right? Like, for instance, one of the reasons where I feel, you know, sort of look at the taxing agriculture income is when I look at the, let's say, a seed production companies, right? Because it gets classified as agriculture activity, we've seen so many stories of how much of taxes has gone, you know, has not really been reported, right? And so in many of these kind of companies that are, you know, in let's say for seed production, for instance, in this specific case, right? So there has been a lot of tax that gets completely diverted, and that's where probably, in the sense of, is there a certain nuance there, Venky, in terms of where we can do that? Yeah,
40% of India is doing farming now. You can't pick up a one seed company or 10 seed companies and show them as an example of taxing 40% of India. That's what I'm trying to get at. We tend to pick and choose what we want to pick up and choose, and then generalize it for the whole community. I agree with you. That's what I said. Exactly. That's what I said. That if there needs to be a forensic audit of these large players who show large agriculture incomes. And the second thing I said is that the income tax department does not have the understanding of farmer incomes or agriculture accounting. And that's why these big companies are allowed to go get away with it as showing agriculture income. It's incomes that these seed companies are making is not on seed production. They're making it on marketing and the royalties. So the income tax department needs to differentiate between what an income is and where that income should be categorized. Should it be categorized as seed production income, which is agriculture, or should it be categorized as because of their marketing and the brand name and the other produce.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, maybe I'd love to take this in a slightly slightly more generalized form of what do you think are ideal farm reforms look like. I've read your commentary on the farm laws and, you know, an entire whatever happened in terms of including the repeal, right? Today at one level, you know, there was an interesting critique in terms of how, because of the current of kind of fertilizer subsidy and all, it almost seems like, you know, we are cushioning the exit of farmers from agriculture with the kind of support we have for kind of the systems that are not anyways are making it much more difficult for us. So from your vantage point, you know, you think that there could be a certain set of ideal farm reforms that you'd probably like, you know, these are the five things that definitely are, like, you know, starters, for instance, to really steer this kind of a conversation.
So let's I think what is required is we need to focus on human resources. Now, human resources is extension services. Human resources is increasing the capacity of IS office. We must begin with IS officers, actually. We must increase the capacity of understanding agriculture, making better agricultural policies. We must invest a lot of money in filling all the posts of extension service officers, which is farm advisories. We must invest in those kinds of things. We must not be investing in infrastructure. The government tends to invest in infrastructure, and we think the government should be prioritizing human resources for the next 10 years to improve agriculture. And I think the other thing is that we need to improve governance. We need to improve regulation, enforcement of regulation, of pesticide use, of fertilizer use. We need to focus on that part of it. So regulation, rules and enforcement, accountability and transparency on how farmers are buying stuff and things like that. So I would just say on two things, human resources. And the third is to document failure and understand failures. Till we don't document failures, we will not know where we are failing and how we are failing. Now, if you look at the Green Revolution today, the whole conversation against Green Revolution is because there is documented evidence that it is failing the way it is today, right? Mm. Now, the same thing should go for every policy. And these failures, the government should allow beneficiaries officially, you know, like if anyone was to do an assessment of a program, there would be nobody who is reading that assessment. So I think the government needs to officially ask beneficiary organizations or those representing the beneficiaries to assess government programs for government understanding of the topic, that they can evolve those policies. I'm not saying policies have to be perfect when they are made, but they need to constantly evolve based on the feedback they get. So first I said is human resources. Now I'm saying that we need to invest in documenting failures. You know, that there will not be any one ideal reform. There will not be any one solution. There will be no final solution on this. This is a constantly evolving system. Agriculture is a state subject where the union government invests a lot of money and effort, and it works like that. So I think so. The ball rests not as much with the union government as it rests with the state government and how they deploy their resources. And to the point about giving fertilizer subsidy to farmers, giving minimum support price. Now, let's be very clear on this. These subsidies are not for farmers. This is for getting cheap grain available to feed India, for feeding consumers, let's say, for India's food security. So it is not with the purpose of helping farmers. Farmers get helped incidentally because these investments are being made like this.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, this few months back, I was driving down in from Hyderabad to Pune, and almost I stopped at a petrol pump, and there I could almost see a poster of, you know, for selling the fertilizer to another place, right? So we see this kind of so much of inefficiencies, and I think that's where also one of the struggles for us. Struggle is to really understand this. But I think your point around cheap food is very, very important. I don't think many people really understand that. Like today, you know, we were at the IRMA summit where we were looked at the transitioning from agroecological paradigm, right? At one level, when I looked at the kind of policies that are shaping up in terms of both, you know, it almost reminds me of what once Arundhati Roy talked about, the sort of policies tend to be like an NTR, right, which plays dual role, right? At one level, you are also the villain, you are also the hero, right? And one almost sees that in the kind of policies we have in the place in the markets, right? So at one level, there is an industrial agricultural paradigm, and that we see certain policies steering towards that. And at the same time, now with the green credits and some of the other initiatives, attempts that are being right now being made, there is also equally a push towards natural farming and agroecological paradigm. How do you see you know, the clash of this paradigm playing out, right? At one level, we're seeing in certain states like Telangana refuses to acknowledge organic farming, and we see that playing out in a certain way, and to a large extent, from whatever I've seen, Maharashtra has also not really been taking active part in agroecological, and they're focusing largely on the industrial, whereas you see in Andhra Pradesh we see agroecology. So from your vantage point, how do you see this clash of paradigms playing out per se?
I don't see a clash of paradigms. Okay. I see that industrial farming is not going anywhere. It's going to be here with us. And I don't see farmers, I mean, I say large number of farmers who are using tractors, combine harvesters, leaving all that and getting into agroecology or getting into natural farming or getting into zero budget farming. I don't see it happening in a very large way. And there are various reasons of it. Reasons for it, but definitely we need to work to reduce. How I would say that we must be focusing on reducing use of chemicals on the farm, by maybe let's say 5 to 10% every year, depending on where every state is. It's possible to do it. When I was with the Farmers Commission in Punjab, we managed to reduce consumption of chemicals by 5% for the last 2-3 years that I was there, and I'm hoping it would still be happening. It all depended on governance. It all depended on enforcement of regulations. It all depended on extension service officers in the state. We also need to find ways to, you know, get financing and private capital involved in the value chain of organic foods. Let's be very fair on this. A large section of organic food market is going to be the urban classes. So we need to get that food. We need to get financing into the place. The central government needs to invest in developing metrics to measure value rather than to replace yields as a value. So today, when you get minimum support price, you get it for the yield, actually, for the quantity. So there is no system where we can value quality. Till you don't value quality, nobody's going to pay for that value. And to move away from the present system of subsidies of fertilizers or on pesticides or on other issues, we need to start looking at payment for farm ecosystem services, you know, environmental services. But what do you pay for? You know, we need to study those topics and issues, and they need to be, it's not going to be something that 10 people can sit together in a workshop over 10 days and come up with a document which says this is how you give it. Maybe that's how you start, but ultimately you will need long-term studies on telling us that how much should, if a farmer was to have, let's say, 10 trees per acre, how much should he be paid for each tree, and what kind of trees would be allowed in which area, or if he did intercropping or row cropping, how much extra would he be paid? We'd also need to change markets. See, today markets are structured, most of the places markets are structured to pick up a particular produce in a particular season. But when you apply principles of natural farming, when you apply principles of agroecology, you will be doing multiple crops at the same time on the same plot or on adjoining plots. So that would require us to even change the design of the markets. And lastly, the most important thing is changing consumer behavior towards healthy diets, not only improving our diets, but also improving the diverse, you know, making our diets more diverse away from a few cereals and few crops. So I think it's a very complex proposition of shifting to agroecology. It should be done, but it cannot be done emotionally. We should disassociate emotion, you know, religion. You know, so many things are now, we are talking about interplay of religion and agro, zero budget farming with cow, with using cow manure, not using buffalo manure or some stuff like that. We have to base our policy on science, on facts, and disassociate completely from emotion. Like you can't scale up a policy because you get emotional about it. You can scale up a policy because you make it economically viable for the country and for farmers. So that kind of approach is, I think, so required. And those who attach ideology for a transformation, I think, so do a disservice towards that transition. If people like Ramdev Baba get into talking about as brand ambassadors for organic stuff, I think nobody's going to do organic farming. So we need to be very clear that these kinds of people, we've got to be very clear that ideology is far removed from the science of agroecology. And I support the science of agroecology, and it needs to be dissociated from these negative influences, which actually divert the attention from the real subject.
When we approach the science of agroecology, one of the common arguments that is made is it's like, can we really determine the true cost of the food, right? And you also talked about it in our conversations, right, where we are stuck in a, whether we like it or not, in a cheap food paradigm, and governments, for their survival, are forced to make sure that part of the problem always exists. Maybe this is a hypothetical question, but I'm just curious, as somebody who works on advocating policies for farmers, can we ever come to a stage where we are able to truly, sort of ascertain the real cost, especially when you take into account the environmental negative externalities that happen, and can we really take into account the cost of the food? How do you see that from a policy perspective?
I think a lot of studies have started now on true cost of food production, true cost accounting of growing food now, but I don't know if those studies will translate into any differences in how agriculture is being supported today. And the biggest challenge remains convincing policymakers, government, scientists, ICAR, those who are responsible for it, that we can feed India with agroecological practices without adversely impacting India's food security and inflation. I think that's the biggest challenge, if you were to say, what's missing. The others is, do remember that farmers grow a crop in a particular way based on market signals and government incentives. So the government is going to make sure that the urea is available to farmers at 2.5 times less than the cost that, let's say, for Punjab, where I am, I'm 10 kilometers or 5 kilometers from the Pakistan border. On the other side of the border, it's 2.5 times more expensive. So obviously, logically, people, practically, people will use more urea because it's cheaply available. And the third part is that, young farmers don't want to get into dirtying their hands on the ground. They all want desk jobs. They don't want to keep cows. If I see, when I babble to villages and I talk to farmers in different places, I ask them, are you keeping cattle? How many cows do you have now? And you realize that less and less farmers are keeping cows in their house. They prefer to buy milk from the neighbors in the village. So there is a change that is happening. And we've got to be very, observant of what's happening, and then base our discussions on such issues. The other challenges to agroecology and policy making is in the sense that politicians make policies not because they like or don't like a policy, but they will not talk about policies or implement policies which translate into election laws. Consumers will prioritize price over quality, and there's a long gestation period about shifting from industrial farming to agroecology. Will people make that? Will people do that? I'm not really too sure. And how you look at agroecology in areas which already have minimum support price incentives for crops based on yield rather than quality, versus those where there are no incentives and it's a rain fed. I think so. They're different paradigms and different ways to look at it.
Yeah, I mean, you touched briefly about the designing for alternative markets from this paradigm, right? One of the challenges right now is happening is, let's say if I'm growing industrial, say, bananas, right? There is like massive volume, and then there is one buyer comes for one day and he takes everything and goes. Whereas if I have to, look at, let's say, an alternative paradigm, somebody who's growing in the natural way, the output volume also gets lower. So I think that's where another challenge there. Yeah.
I mean, there are multiple issues, about how it's going to work, and I don't think so. There's a political will to it. If you look at the BJP, I think so. No party in power till today has made so much noise about natural farming as BJP has done. You got to acknowledge that part. I mean, if they put where money where the mouth is, no, obviously not. But the amount of awareness that they have built on agroecology, or not even agroecology, on organic farming and natural farming, or on agroecology, it's a lot. They've got so many schemes which are named for this purpose, but obviously the funding is not there. But I think this all depends on, that's where politics comes in. Depending on what kind of ideology you're supporting as a political party, you will support these issues.
Great. I think while we hope that at least at some level that we bring in the policies towards larger issues there. But I think thank you very much for this conversation. I it was quite eye opening in many aspects, in some of the nuances that you really touched upon. Thank you for joining this.
Thank you, Venki. Thank you for having me here. I think it's been a wonderful conversation, And please continue the good work you're doing, spreading the message. You know, you are one of the tools of incepting ideas into consumers. Like you asking me how to incept ideas. So, Venki, you are one of the tools of incepting these ideas into consumers. Ask the questions that nobody is asking. That's what I would suggest as a farmers organization.
Great. I hope that it translates into better policies there. And thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Yeah.